All right. Well, thanks very much. It's my pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me out. Just before we start, like, if I can make a suggestion for the future, like, we might consider doing these outside, you know? Just saying. But that's up to you. All right, so, you know, of course, I'm sure everybody here is aware of the fact that the last two decades have been revolutionary in terms of detection of planets around other stars. So our count, I've lost count, to be completely honest, of how many exoplanets there are now. It's 4,000 or something like that. So we have been clearly winning on the exoplanet front. And in the meantime, in the solar system, we have been losing. Okay? And in 2006, we went from 9 planets to 8 planets with the demotion of Pluto. So today, I wanna talk about how to make the solar system great again and return it to its former 9-planet glory, right? So what is staggering is that the solar system has had literally two additions, two planetary additions, two legitimate planetary additions in its entire, in the entire history of humankind, right? Because everything out to Saturn, you can just see with the naked eye, so the Greeks and the Romans just knew about everything out to Saturn. And the first addition of a planet to the solar system came right around 1776, towards the end of the Revolutionary War, when Herschel announced the discovery of an object which was very, very slowly moving across the night sky. So Herschel was exceedingly meticulous in the way that he observed. He just observed every night and drew everything he saw every night, right? So it was because of that consistency that he was able to note that this particular dim star was slowly moving across the night sky. And so he said, "Oh, wow, this has got to be this has got to be a planet." And what was immediately realized is that the particular star he was referring to had been observed before many, many times, including by Galileo himself. So the orbit of this new object was immediately reconstructed, right? So they knew what was going on. And by the way, Herschel, you know, being a English character, decided to kind of cheer up the king, who was kind of depressed at the time because he was kind of losing, and said, "We'll name this planet George." Okay, so we'll have Jupiter, Saturn, and George. You know, and that actually persisted for about 50 years, after which, just like whatever the equivalent of IAU, you know, at the time said, "This is a terrible name for a planet, right? Let's instead call it Uranus." So that was the story of how George was discovered. Now, what was interesting is that almost immediately, astronomers realized that something was wrong with the orbit. And this is a slide from the memoirs from 1821 of Alexis Bouvard. Alexis Bouvard was the director of the Parisian Observatory, and he took it upon himself to kind of collect all the legacy observations of Uranus and put them together in a table, and point out, kind of, you know, compile the data set, so to speak. And I don't speak French, but you can clearly tell that something is wrong with the orbit because there's sines and cosines, right, over here, and there's a table over there with pluses and minuses. So it's clear. And also, I've highlighted the word Uranus to just demonstrate that I'm on the right page. What evidently Bouvard writes about in here is that Uranus is not where it should have been, right? The perturbation theories of, I mean, the like thing to do if you were a mathematician at the time was to construct kind of perturbative, you know, solutions for the motions of planets. And, you know, Uranus was not observed where it was supposed to be, right? So in here, on this page, Bouvard speculates that there's two solutions. Being a good theorist, he proposed, number one, that the data is crappy and should not be believed, right? And he said, on the off chance that the data is right, then what this suggests is that there exists an additional object beyond the orbit of Uranus, which is causing the perturbation, causing Uranus to veer off course. So the promise of that data set, and remember that was 1821, took a couple decades for it to really come to fruition, and the character which is typically credited with the mathematical discovery of Neptune is Urbain Le Verrier. So Le Verrier did a extremely careful and just remarkably complicated calculation to demonstrate that you could explain the anomalies in the Uranian motion with the existence of an additional planet in the solar system. When I was an undergrad, I went to UC Santa Cruz, and I lived in kind of shaky part of town, so I can spot a gangsta from far away. So I kind of know to not make eye contact. And this is, I mean, Le Verrier is clearly has all the signs, because he's got his bling, right, that he's wearing on outside. His stage name is Urban, right? It's, yeah, what a guy. So I like to, you can download Le Verrier's manuscript online, and it is totally unreadable. But it is interesting to just scroll through it, because it's staggering just how much calculation went into that discovery. What is even more intriguing, perhaps, is that when Le Verrier was done with this calculation, which was in 1846, he went to the Parisian Observatory and gave this talk where basically he provided the coordinates for this elusive, invisible planet to try and cheer up the observers, to get them to come out and confirm his calculations. And it was very warmly received. In fact, Airy, of course, who was a very famous geophysicist at the time, said, "I cannot attempt to convey the impression which was made on me by the author's undoubting confidence, but the firmness with which he proclaimed to the observing astronomers, quote, look into the place which I have indicated and you will see the planet well." So he was exceedingly confident of his calculations. And what's interesting is that the observers were like, "Yeah, it's cool math, bro, but like, you realize we have to stay up at night for this, and that's kind of a big commitment you're asking us to make." So they did nothing, okay? He in the end drummed up very little enthusiasm among the French observers to go out and find Neptune. In the end, it was a German observer by the last name Gall who found it, and Gall was very meticulous as well. They had this campaign planned on how they were going to search for, the predicted planet. On first night of the observation run, the sky went dark, they opened up the dome, found Neptune. It was within 1 hour. Okay, that was it. It was remarkable, right, how well it worked. And what is even more, in my view, staggering is that it all worked out because it was 1846. Okay, so like the timing here was everything. Here's a plot of the real orbit of Neptune and the predicted orbit of Neptune by Le Verrier. His contemporary Adams at Cambridge did similar calculations. It has recently turned out that Adams, so for a long time people believed that they were truly contemporaries. It has recently turned out, by the discovery of some set of letters, the details are murky to me, but that Adams basically was late to the game. He presented his theoretical prediction after the planet was already discovered. So he was working on this, but he didn't have the right coordinates. One way or another, both of them predicted this orbit that had a period that was too long, and a mass for Neptune that was too big, okay? And the reason they got it wrong was because they assumed that the planetary semi-major axes have to follow a geometric sequence, what is now known as the Titius-Bode law, which is not really a law. So they got the orbit wrong, but they got the location in the night sky right. And the reason is that in 1846, Uranus and Neptune were close to conjunction, So you could basically do that problem in a shearing sheet, and you would get the same answer, right? So what's interesting is that Neptune has gone around the sun approximately one time since then. And if you were to repeat this calculation in 2011, when Neptune returned to where it started from, Le Verrier would have predicted Neptune to be here and Adams here. So it's like show business, right? You gotta be in the right place at the right time. You gotta be in Paris, 1846. That was the place to be. Nevertheless, this discovery made a huge impression on everyone. Not everyone was impressed. A hipster from Cambridge, Massachusetts said that this calculation was nothing but a happy accident. And Benjamin Pierce, in fact, was highly influential in getting kind of American astronomers interested in continuing this stats. He said that whatever Le Verrier did was kind of worked out coincidentally. Let's do the real calculation, find the next planet over using the same technique. And the reason, interestingly, the reason he thought you could do it is because even though Neptune had cleansed most of the errors from the Uranian data set, it didn't cleanse all of them. That was because they didn't have the mass of Neptune down, you know, to the exactly correct value. So he said, look, there's still some anomalies in the data that we can go after. And he strongly influenced Parsifal Lowell, who founded the Lowell Observatory and came from an exceedingly wealthy family in Massachusetts. Basically, at one point, asked his dad for a telescope. So his dad bought him a telescope. and so Lowell spent the rest of his life looking for Planet X. And in fact, he came up with the word Planet X. didn't find it, died in 1916. His last published work was called Memoirs on the Search for Planet X, where he provided a set of coordinates. He actually didn't do any calculations himself. He took the kind of like Ford production line approach to finding planets. So he hired computers, right, to just carry out the calculations for him. And he kind of, in the time that he spent working on this, he had at one point doubled the number of computers. So long story short, Planet X, Lowell died without having found Planet X. Planet X was eventually discovered by Clyde Tombaugh. Here's a real life picture of him. You can also buy his biography in children's book format, you know, which is a little faster to read. So Clyde Tombaugh was employed by the Lowell Observatory after the death of Lowell himself to just search for the night sky, follow the predictions. And indeed, he found Planet X. If you read the front page, The New York Times on March 14th, 1930, okay? It's actually pretty interesting. There's a lot of interesting stuff here, but if you zoom in to right over here, it says that astronomers hail finding the sphere possibly larger than Jupiter. Remember, Jupiter is 300 Earth masses, and 4 billion miles away meets predictions, right? So, you know, it looks like Lowell was right after all. Of course, today we know that that's not true. What they found was Pluto. Okay, Pluto, if you put Pluto on top of Australia, it fits, right? That's how small Pluto really is. So really the Pluto's planetary status was derived entirely from this legacy of trying to predict additional objects mathematically. Its mass wasn't measured until the 70s when it was discovered that it has a satellite. And then people were like, what? This thing is tiny. It's 5,000 times less massive than the Earth. So that's kind of the story of the failure of finding new planets throughout the 20th century. So even though no additional planetary objects were discovered in the distant solar system at the turn of the century, what astronomers did find was the Kuiper Belt. So this is the solar system viewed from top. That blue circle is the Earth orbit. So my house is right there. Okay, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. This is the orbit of Pluto. Note, by the way, that the orbit of Pluto overlaps the orbit of Neptune. The reason they stay stable is because they're locked in a mean motion resonance. So for every three orbits that Pluto completes, Neptune completes, Pluto completes too. And in a second, we'll see all the Kuiper Belt objects with well-defined orbits that are known at the moment. Right, so there's about a couple thousand of them. Each one is not very massive at all. Cumulatively, the Kuiper Belt is only about 0.1 Earth masses, maybe even less than that. So they're basically test particles orbiting outside of Neptune, and we've derived a lot of knowledge about how the solar system formed by studying the Kuiper Belt. But the one thing I guess I want you to focus on is the fact that if you look at the orbits, and the dynamical structure of the Kuiper Belt is exceedingly interesting, by the way. Okay? There are subsets of Kuiper Belt objects that are rapidly chaotic. Pluto is actually one of them. Pluto loses memory of its own initial conditions in 20 million years, so it's Lyapunov times of order 20 million years, and there's other interesting stuff. But for the purposes of what I'm going to talk about, it's only relevant to note that all the orbits more or less hug the orbit of Neptune physically. Okay? And this is because this entire population of icy debris was emplaced into their current orbits through scattering off of Neptune. And gravity being conservative, you know, and requires you to come back to where you started from. So the orbits change chaotically on long timescales, but they remained gravitationally tethered to Neptune. And this is something that is shared across all, essentially all dynamical classes within the Kuiper Belt. So that's fine. And there's no, if you just look at this, there's no evidence of there being anything wrong with the solar system, except for in 2003, okay, my partner in crime, Mike Brown, who's my co-author on this work, discovered Sedna together with Chad Trujillo and Scott Shepard. So you don't have to be an expert in the Kuiper Belt to note that something is horrifically wrong with Sedna. Right. First of all, at aphelion over here, it's about 1,000 astronomical units. Right. So it's kind of in a logarithmic sense, it is flirting with being an inner Oort cloud object. If that's all it was, I would say that's not really a big deal. I would say, well, it's just scattered off of Neptune and acquired an energy of almost zero, just slightly negative. So it's almost on an unbound orbit, but no. The really interesting thing about Sedna is that it's not elliptical enough. Okay, so at perihelion, it never comes to hug the orbit of Neptune. And you can integrate, you know, the n-body problem with Sedna forever. And all it will do is its orbit will just slowly precess, right? Nothing will change. It never comes in, its eccentricity doesn't vary. It just doesn't hug Neptune. So what this means is that Neptune could not have emplaced Sedna into its current orbit. Something other than interactions with Neptune are responsible for the orbit. For a long time, for about a decade, this was the example of a detached Kuiper Belt object. And people said, I don't know this. Okay. Right, because that's kind of how it was. In 2013, however, Joe Biden was discovered orbiting the sun, okay, by, again, Chad Trujillo. Right, so they found Joe Biden on an orbit like this. And even at closest approach, right, Joe Biden comes in only at 80 astronomical units, nowhere near the 30, which is the semi-major axis of Neptune. And it's like, if you have two data points, like, you gotta make a theory, right? If you have one, you ignore it. If two, it's hands down. Right? You can draw a line through them. So this was actually our starting point, right? We were just like, what? Pretty interesting. And, you know, the first thing that we did was we studied carefully the paper of Trujillo and Shepard, and in there, they pointed out that if you look at the arguments of perihelion, which are So arguments of perihelion are weird angle. They are the angle that an orbit makes when it crosses the ecliptic, between where it crosses the ecliptic plane and where it comes to perihelion. So it's an angle which is actually dependent on which plane you measure it from. And they noted that they all kind of, if you look at the distant orbits, they're all close to zero. But if you actually look at the graph, they're close to like minus 53. You know, there's some spread, and I was just like, what is that? So that was our starting point. And upon looking at the data, the first thing that we immediately noted is that simply if you restrict yourself to orbits that are orbital periods 4,000 years and greater, then all the orbits of distant Kuiper Belt objects more or less lie in the same plane. So if we translate ourselves to the ecliptic, we'd almost imagine putting a piece of paper that is about 21 degrees inclined through that group of bodies. Moreover, they all point towards me, right? And I know I'm gravitationally attractive, right? But it's just like, this is odd. It's odd that beyond a certain critical semi-major axis, all of a sudden the Laplace plane of the solar system, if you will, tilts, and all the orbits point toward me. Okay, so you can say, well, hold on there. There's six objects, right? This is like, don't be a king of small data. but you can ask yourself the following question. If you were to just randomly select among the known Kuiper Belt objects, right, which are discovered at similar radial separations, six objects, how often will you get grouping of the angles this good? And the answer is about 0.007% of the time. Okay, so the false alarm probability, if you will, that this is due to chance is quite low. Okay. The good news is since then, this data set has tripled more or less, and to leading order, everything is still very much intact. I mean, this cluster has gotten much stronger. So what is happening, right? I mean, some strange things are happening beyond 250 astronomical units. And by the way, in 2016, I met Alex Winter, and he has aged exactly 0 days, which makes sense because in the plot of Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, they have a time machine. So I never understood that that movie was a documentary. Okay, so Mike and I, are firm believers that crazy people propose planets beyond Neptune, right? It's just like if you type in Planet X into Google before 2016, it was just crazy people on like Vixra, you know, screaming at each other, and just blogs and stuff. So it's a very uncomfortable thing to do. The problem is that literally no other explanation works. The first model we actually developed was one where I thought, well, there's this cluster of orbits, and they're far enough away that the orbits of the giant planets just look more or less like a quadrupole moment of the sun, right? You can phase average them, just replace them with massive rings. Maybe there's just enough mass in the distant Kuiper Belt that it self-modulates, and that kind of forms this eccentric, you know, lobed structure. So you can work through the calculations. Turns out that works rather well if there was about 10,000 times more mass in the Kuiper Belt than we know there is. So that the Kuiper Belt would simply be brighter. We would observe a lot more objects in that explanation. So that can't be right. I thought maybe it's due to a passing star, right? Maybe a passing star created some pattern, and we're now seeing the legacy of that. Turns out that's very uncomfortable as well, because each one of these objects has a distinct semi-major axis, so their precession rates are very, very different from one another. So within a geologically short period of time, only about 100 million years, this pattern would disperse. Right? So something extant is needed to explain the orbits. So the problem is that you can basically come up with whatever you want, okay? When you introduce a planet, you've got 7 parameters to choose, and that's a lot of parameters. So the first thing that I did is I thought, okay, well, what would Le Verrier do? Right, Le Verrier would be able to write this down on like a piece of paper and figure it out. And it turns out the only configuration you can write down on a piece of paper and solve the problem in a more or less analytic way is that if you introduce a planet into that cluster and say, okay, on secular, via secular interactions, this configuration of orbits is kept together by a planet. Indeed, you can write down an integrable Hamiltonian that approximates that problem, and you can demonstrate with this integrable Hamiltonian that if the planet is the answer, then the planet has to be of order 10 Earth masses, and its orbit has to be eccentric. Okay, so it requires eccentricities above 0.3. Preferably above 0.5, something like that. So just a simple perturbative calculation can give you some insight into what the planetary parameters should be. I've since revisited this approach with Alessandro Morbidelli, who's a mathematician in Nice, France, and we came up with a different integrable Hamiltonian, which handles the opposite case, where if you anti-align the planet with respect to the cluster of the orbits. Turns out in both cases, you get roughly the same constraints. The good news is, despite what you may kind of derive from the news cycle, it is no longer 1846, right? It truly is not. And so the good news is that at the end of the day, we're not limited to just doing things on the board, and we can do numerical experiments. So the numerical experiments that we carried out are as follows. Quite simple. You start the solar system in its nascent state 4 billion years ago when the Kuiper Belt just formed. And here you have all of the giant planets right in this little circle. This is the orbit of planet 9, of the parameters of which you set. And you basically let it go, right? Let it gravitationally evolve. In gold, the orbits shown in gold are those with semi-major axes smaller than 250 AU, so they are representative of the conventional Kuiper Belt that doesn't have coherent structure. And all of the blue orbits are those with orbital periods greater than 4,000 years. So they are the ones that show this weird clustering. And you can do these calculations relatively cheaply. They only take about a week each, so you can iterate over the parameters of Planet 9 a lot. And for a long time, just nothing happens in these calculations. It's only about 2 billion years in, which is right around now, that some structure begins to emerge. And this structure, I think you will join me, or either I'm crazy, or you will join me in agreeing that there's more orbits pointing that way than there are together with Planet 9. So the dynamics here is actually beautifully intricate. All of these orbits that are long-term stable started out by coincidence locked into a mean motion resonance with Planet 9. So just by virtue of being scattered out by Neptune and acquiring a random set of orbital parameters, they were locked by coincidence into a commensurability just like Pluto and Neptune itself. But that is the mechanism that allows them to remain stable for long periods of time. That's what keeps them from being flung out, whereas all these guys weren't. The actual confinement of the major axes is a secular effect. That's a mean field. In order to understand that, you have to average over the orbital motions under the resonant condition. So all of this stuff is now worked out in that new paper I just mentioned, and we understand this pretty well. So long story short, you can iterate over the parameters of Planet 9 numerically and find that the best fit more or less lies in indeed a 10 Earth mass object with a semi-major axis, of order 700 astronomical units, right? So similar size to like the orbits of Sedna and these other guys, and a highly eccentric orbit. Sorry, eccentricity of 0.6 gives you a good match. And note that it also lies roughly in the same plane as the observed Kuiper Belt objects themselves. So that's kind of what is responsible for the tilting of the Laplace plane of the solar system. So this is great. I typically tell my students that if you have a theory, right, that explains the data you were aiming to explain, then you should give yourself a B. Okay, you should give at best a B plus. Like if you're feeling good, right, about your theory, it should be a B plus. And the reason it's not an A is because you haven't made, if you just explain the data that you have at hand, and you propose something with adjustable parameters you haven't made any predictions, right? It's difficult to confirm or refute that model looking forward. And so while writing this up, this is something that was lingering in my mind, that Planet Nine that simply explains what we see, and it's kind of uncomfortable. Until I noticed this, okay? And this is really something that at the like end of writing out the paper, noted that every successful simulation that we have, right, there's a population of objects that gets produced that start out at low orbital inclinations, right? So this is the inclination with respect to the plane of the solar system, and get taken up to a very high inclination, in fact, a retrograde one, and then come back down. And through this cycle, they become visible right around over here where the lines have color, okay? And so I thought, now this would be a really interesting prediction. Nobody ever observes outside of the ecliptic plane, okay? Because you don't want to be wasting telescope time looking into empty space, right? So when you look for Kuiper Belt objects, you don't look for things on highly inclined orbits. And printed out this exact page, and I went down the hall to Mike's office, I said, this would be an actual observational prediction, right, that we could make, that, you know, if Planet Nine is really there, it would entail the existence of objects that orbit the solar system in essentially perpendicular sense. And Mike was like, wait, I think Dr. 30 does that. And I was like, what? He was like, yeah, Dr. 30 is an object that was discovered by accident by a near-Earth asteroid survey that was just looking for stuff. And when you look for near-Earth asteroids, you don't discriminate on the night sky. You just look everywhere because you're going to have a pretty embarrassing last couple hours of your life, right, as you try to explain to the president that, well, you know, we didn't see the killer asteroid coming from an inclined orbit because we only looked in the ecliptic plane, right? So Mike was like, yeah, there's this object. I remember it from 2014 or whatever. It was discovered, and then nobody thought it was a big deal, but it had an inclination of order 90 degrees. And so, you know, just dug through, kind of dumpster dived into this data set and noted that there had been about five of these objects already discovered, okay? We had no idea that they were there, but they are more or less exactly where the model predicts them to be. And if you look at what they appear like in physical space, they kind of look like the wings of the solar system. And they're totally wild. I can't believe we missed them. We like weren't aware because they're totally crazy. I mean, this guy has a semi-major axis of like 1500 AU. So they're much more staggering than Sedna, for example. And again, since this original discovery, they found another one, which is right about here. So in my view, this picture actually is the refutability and of the model. If this pattern where we have a set of clustered orbits pointing opposite way from planet 9 goes away, and if these wings become better, kind of more axisymmetrically distributed around the solar system, then we're just wrong. But so far, it's holding up very well where this nearly orthogonal set of orbits, which is, like I said, a prediction of the model. It's really a retrodiction, actually, because the data was already there. But that's something that that is dear to us. Okay, so this was, so those three lines of evidence cumulatively was what we published back in 2016. So we said, number one, Planet 9 confines these distant orbits into a cluster. Number two, as they rattle around within that cluster via secular interactions, their eccentricities go up and down. So that is a process to remove the perihelion from Neptune. So some of the initially attached Kuiper Belt objects become detached and then reattach back to Neptune. So we're observing Sedna and Joe Biden in a state at the moment when they are at the detached part of their cycle. If we wait a couple hundred million years, they will reattach back to Neptune, and some of the more garden variety Kuiper Belt objects will become like Sedna and Joe Biden. And then this set of wings, this set of highly inclined bodies that we didn't know were there. So these three lines of evidence are what we believe makes up a compelling story for the existence of Planet 9. And then about a year later, maybe 6 months later, I was on a run, I had my iPhone with me, and I got a call. It was from a reporter. I said, yeah. And the reporter said, okay, so there's huge news in the Kuiper Belt. Okay, they found an object which is orbiting the sun the wrong way. Okay, and I said, what do you mean it's orbiting the sun the wrong way? Like, there's no right way or wrong way to orbit the sun. And it was like, what kind of an astronomer are you? You don't even know that there's a right way and a wrong way? You know, I said, well, hold on. It's like, I think where you're getting at is the like retrograde? It's like going opposite from everywhere else. And I said, yeah. And then I sort of told this exact story that I just presented to you. I said, oh yeah, Planet 9, blah, blah, blah. It takes orbits and puts them onto retrograde orbits. And then I, you know, ran back to my office and opened the email and found that I was completely off, right? So what they had discovered is an object parked right next to Neptune, okay, on a nearly circular orbit. It was a little bit retrograde. But you should never, you know, give up, right? Just because logic tells you to. So it's like, okay, this is odd. I looked at it through the literature on solar system formation. There's no way to make Kuiper Belt objects like these, right? So I thought, what about all the objects we threw away, right? Because as you saw in that movie from a few slides ago, we started out with a lot more blue ellipses than we ended with, and that's because a lot of these blue ellipses got scattered out or got scattered in, okay? So Neptune, you know, basically is a machine of perturbing things out and in. And for things that just went into the inner solar system, or what we typically call the outer solar system, but to me, everything inside of Neptune is the inner solar system, right? Everything that went inside of Neptune, I just deleted, or just didn't keep track of, because I figured it doesn't matter, right? These things go in and become Jupiter family comets or whatever. They're not interesting. But then I went back and revisited all the objects that were thrown away and found that actually a lot of them do really interesting, cool stuff, right? So here's again Planet 9. Here's a body that started out on some random orbits. As you can see, it's kind of flipping upside down chaotically. Its orbit is changing. But every time it comes to hug the orbit of Neptune, it gets scattered, right? So it gets whipped around. And its semi-major axis changes, right, in a random way. And so eventually, this guy comes down and becomes parked right outside of Neptune on a nearly circular orbit. So if you liked it, then you should have put a ring on it. Okay, that's the moral of the story here.
And what's the time scale, right?
So this was 4 billion years, and I chose this particular particle because it starts out on some random orbit and it ends exactly as this new object that was discovered after the fact. So the two orbits are truly within, you know, 1% of one another. And this is not because there's something, you know, special about that orbit. They actually go all over the place. Okay? It's just that, you know, we found one that really reproduces the data point.
Can you give us a sense of the masses of the different objects you're talking
about? Yeah, so.
Sure.
Absolutely. So Planet 9 itself is 10 Earth masses in this simulation. 10 Earth masses. 10 Earth masses is a strange range because it's between the Earth and Neptune, Uranus, which are 17 or 18 respectively, right? It's considerably smaller than Jupiter and Saturn, which are 390. But what is remarkable is if you look at the catalog of extrasolar planets, 10 Earth masses is the most common type of object you will find. Maybe 8, I don't know, but something around there, kind of in between the Earth and Neptune, is the most common type of body. What about the Kuiper Belt objects? The Kuiper Belt objects, the biggest ones, well, the biggest ones are, of course, Pluto, and there's a few other ones there, about 1,000 kilometers across. That's of order 10 to the minus 9 solar masses. The remainder of them, vast majority of them, are the size of LA. Okay, maybe size of Santa Barbara. So they're really, yeah, they're test particles.
Would distant civilization, would Planet 9 be the first planet they would notice around this particular star?
Well, Planet 9, if they were observing the sun within the first million years when it was still forming, because you can, I mean, all of the distant extrasolar planets that we've found via direct imaging are those that are still in the process of emitting their heat. So it's through gravitational contraction. So their effective temperatures are, you know, 1,000 degrees. Planet 9's effective temperature is 40 Kelvin, right? So you would need a very remarkable infrared instrument plus a very nice coronagraph to detect Planet 9. In fact, the WISE mission, which was our premier infrared survey of the night sky, barely detected Neptune. Okay, so Neptune was detected with a signal to noise of order 6, if I remember correctly. So if you put Neptune a factor of 2 further away, it disappears. Okay, so this prompted us to look deeper into the data set. Right, we thought, okay, so are there more objects? Turns out there are a lot more objects on retrograde Kuiper Belt orbits that are parked right next to Neptune. And it's not actually clear why that discovery was a big deal in the news, because there's a few more of them. Okay, and so the one that made the big time is like this one, right? But it's not particularly more special than this, and it's definitely not as interesting as this guy, which is in the plane of the solar system, more or less, but is truly going the wrong way. So, I also drew a line here because everything out to about 45 degrees, you can manage to generate during solar system formation. Everything above is just completely hopeless. So where does Planet 9 emplace objects from afar? Turns out there's an intriguing pattern to how it emplaces objects. This region over here is devoid of bodies, and that has to do with the specific resonance that tilts the orbits and where it comes to low perihelion during the inclination cycle. So there's kind of a large population. We expect a large population above 90 and a somewhat smaller population, which is almost retrograde. I should have updated this plot with the new. There's been a couple more discoveries. There's one here and another one here, which both fit very nicely. Final thing about Planet 9 that I'll mention today. So you guys all know about the sun, right? You know, I'm sure your parents at some point told you not to look directly at the sun. Sir Carrington in 1859 did not follow that advice, okay, and instead and measured the sun directly. He was the first person to measure the spin axis of the sun, okay, and pointed out that if you kind of look at how star spots move, you will note that the spin axis of the sun is 6 degrees offset with respect to the plane of the solar system. And in that paper, which you can download on ADS, right, he said he knows that, gee, this is weird. The planets are coplanar to less than a degree, all right, whereas the sun is off by 6. And I actually knew about this like before Planet Nine, and I've talked to like my office mates about this, and we all concluded that it doesn't matter because 6 is just not that many degrees, right? And it's true, like 6 is small compared to 90, but 6 is also big compared to 1. You see, like that's the kind of math that I'm into. So, you know, I'm just like, what's going on with the 6 degrees? Actually, to be completely fair, I thought the 6 degrees was a big deal back in 2012. I'm like a 6 degrees hipster. Right? I was like into the 6 degrees before it was popular. And in 2012, I wrote a paper about how, well, if the solar system formed as a binary star, which many sun-like stars do, then the binary could have perturbed the disk of the solar system out of alignment with the host star, and then the binary gets stripped by just binary-binary interactions in the cluster. So I kind of knew how to do this calculation. At the time, Elizabeth Bailey, who's my grad student, was just starting, and said, why don't you calculate, you know, given the torque, like we know the orbit of Planet Nine, what torque does it exert upon not the protoplanetary disk of the solar system, but the planets themselves, right? Because if Planet Nine torques the rest of the solar system by 25 degrees in 4 billion years, we're in trouble because 25 is bigger than 6. If it's 0 degrees, then it just doesn't matter. And you know, she did the calculation, right, and demonstrated that in 4.5 billion years, Planet Nine torques the solar system by 6 degrees. Okay, and moreover, it's not just 6 degrees; it torques them. It torques the sun. Well, tilts the solar system in such a way that the longitude into which the sun is tilted is the correct one. So you can, by knowing, you know, the orbit of Planet Nine, and the tilt of the sun, compute the plane of the distant Kuiper Belt objects and vice versa. Right? So this doesn't have to be right, okay? At the end of the day, you know, maybe, you know, this Planet Nine contributed not the full 6 degrees. Maybe there are other explanations, like I said, with the binary star or whatever, for generating this obliquity, but the fact that it fits as well as it does, I think is kind of staggering. Whereas I think this is not, I wouldn't jump, if this was the only line of evidence for the existence of Planet Nine, I would, you know, it would be laughable. But the fact that it works as well as it does is pretty interesting in my view. Okay, so we're getting close to the end here. As I said, there's a lot more objects now. The cluster gets better. There's a few now that were found which are exactly diametrically aligned with Planet Nine. These guys are interesting. These guys are also something that comes out of the model naturally. These are locked in a secular libration cycle where their libration amplitudes are so low that they're protected from collisions in a different way. They just simply never touch the orbit of Planet Nine. So the picture continues to kind of refine and get better. So I think that we are in good shape as we, you know, conduct the observational search, which is what we are into at the moment. So let me quickly summarize. What do we think we know about Planet Nine? We think that Planet Nine has an orbital period of about 20,000 years. It's about 700 astronomical units, a mass about 10 times that of the Earth. Of course, we haven't seen it. It could be a dark matter black hole, right? So it could have which is interesting because that's the same as a regular black hole. But you know, if you just don't go into, again, crazy land, planets of this type, if you look at the extrasolar catalog, typically have radii between 2 and 4 times that of the Earth. And it's on an eccentric orbit. It's not quite cometary, right? It's not like a comet, but it's halfway in between having a comet-like orbit and typical planet-like orbit. If we assume that it's got a radius of about 3 Earth masses, what we expect, and an albedo similar to that of Neptune, it would be visual magnitude 24. I'm not an observing person, but I recently learned that that means really dim, okay? But the good news about magnitude 24 is that there is a telescope with a large field of view, which does the job. And so this is the top of Mauna Kea on the Big Island. This is the Subaru telescope, which is incredible. Here's a picture of Mike and I inside the telescope, so it is kind of, you know, fully in line with my Japanese, you know, background. This looks like a mega Godzilla, right? And it is truly staggering, right? When the picture doesn't do it justice, just how big it is. And I think the camera was, the CCD is actually the largest CCD ever commissioned, because it was commissioned to bail out a fraction of the engineers during the economic recession in the 90s. So this was an incredible telescope. So we are conducting our search at the moment. We have covered, I'll tell you how much we've covered. We were at the telescope in late September, and we had 5 nights, well, 5 half nights. And for the first 2 nights, the weather was supposed to be bad, and we were groggy, but then, like, you know, chaotically, as all weather does, you know, a bubble of warm air appeared on top of Hawaii. And so there was all this rain that was in circulation around the island. We could sort of see the clouds, you know, kind of going around us, but we had beautiful, you know, seeing on the first 2 nights, and then the final 3 nights were really, really great. So we covered about this much sky, which is about 20% of what we need in total. So we have the orbit and the location in the night sky constrained to about 5 times what I'm showing at the moment. We're going back to the telescope in mid-December. Hopefully the same exact thing will happen, right? And we'll have awesome nights. But because, you know, because you guys have been good to me, I'll just tell you where Planet Nine is, just so that you know. And you can be Planet Nine hipsters and sort of say, yeah, well, I already knew where it was, you know, when you find it. So this is the Orion constellation, okay? I noticed, named my cat Orion back in 2008. And so this is the one constellation that I actually know. And over here, Orion is holding usually a shield or a bow. People tell me that this star is not Planet Nine, and I tend to believe them, but our best estimates put Planet Nine very close to it, so it's probably somewhere in Orion's shield. Okay. All right, so I'll stop here and take any questions. All right, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And you have a bunch of dots on there with different
color, yeah.
Yeah, can you explain what that plot is showing?
Sure,
What the color is.
Thank you, and to give credit to my grad student, Chris Spalding, he has instructed me to never show that plot because he said it looks at best like modern art. So what that plot is showing on the y-axis is the inclination. On the x-axis is the apsidal direction of the orbits. So the point there being is that as the orbits come up and execute a very well-defined kind of pattern in that space, right? There's a well-defined, just having a bunch of inclined orbits is not consistent with the model, right? They need to follow what the model predicts. And then you may have noted that the lines had different opacity, or the dots had different opacity. So where the objects have perihelia greater than 80 astronomical units, which is kind of as far as our current observational horizon stretches, I plotted them in gray. And where they are, where they have color, they are in not gray. So point being is that they're most readily observable at about 90 degrees. And they disappear from sight over here at the highest inclination. And they are also not very observable in this part of the flow. Right? So they come to perihelion at almost 90 degrees. Okay? I should also caution that the observed objects, even though they fall right where they should be, are the freaks of this population. They're the freaks of this population because they were discovered by this near asteroid survey, which is not very sensitive to the Kuiper Belt. So it picked out the things with perihelion distances inside the solar system. And their perihelion distances are 11 AU, 9 AU. So these are things that are hugging the giant planets. So they have been more or less perturbed out of this perfect. So the fact that they're kind of on the edges is because they've been kicked by the giant planets already. Part of the survey that we're doing is done in hopes of discovering more of these guys with perihelion well beyond Neptune that should map much better to these lines. That's a great question, and yes, it can. So we are the way that we are doing the observational search is so it turns out, like I was last year was my first time observing. Turns out it's super easy, right? You just upload a set of targets, and then you just occasionally press up enter, just to make sure that you know it's doing well, I thought it was much more magical than what it really is. So what we're doing is we're taking a stamp of the night sky, so a 2-minute exposure, which on a clear night, so seeing kind of below 1 arcsecond, gets you down to about 25th. Okay, so there are objects, in fact, discovered that are 25th magnitude. And then we just follow that down. We just stamp down, and then kind of comb the night sky that way. And that's all it is. It's very simplistic in that all we're looking for is just reflected light, right? There are theoretical calculations of the atmosphere and what happens when you're at 40K, which suggests that everything should condense out and you should just have Rayleigh scattering. So the atmosphere should light up like a mirror, and it should have an albedo of 0.9 or something like that, which would be great. I am cautious to, you know, jump up and down about this, just because I always worry. I always like to be on the pessimistic side. So there's a chance that Planet 9 is actually brighter than 24. There's also a great chance that it's in the galactic plane, which would be very difficult. Yeah, if only we could just remove the galaxy, right? I mean, do I have any supporters in this room? No.
So, how would you identify the survey? Looking for proper motion, or something like that? And then, if you complete the survey and you don't see anything down from 24, is there still hiding in some other part of space, or will you then say that it doesn't exist?
It's a great question. You complete the. So with these things, there's always kind of your best 1 sigma set of orbits. You can keep expanding that. After a while, you do run out of reasonable sky. The way we search for Planet 9 is very simple. It's basically not moving, right? So it's all parallax, okay? And if we find an object that bright at a distance of 1,000 AU, it has got to be big. Okay? And then so suppose, you know, in December when we go back, we find an object that is that big. What's the next step? The next step is to get Hubble time, try to resolve it. If it has satellites, then we know the mass for free. If it doesn't, it's going to have satellites. Don't even go there. Okay. The other thing you can do is, of course, observe it with something like Keck and get a spectrum of the atmosphere. You immediately learn something about the composition. I'm almost certain that an object of 10 Earth masses must have a hydrogen helium envelope, right? It's not a ball. It's not like the Earth. It's more like Neptune. So then the question is, if we don't find it, what does it mean? Well, you know, unfortunately, it's not super clear cut because of the galaxy that's in the way. If a large fraction of the aphelion part of the orbit covers the galaxy and the galaxy just get confusion. So then you have to, and it's actually not even clear if with the current generation of telescopes we can solve that problem. So we have some more time in February, and in February we're going to do our first experiment with observing kind of the edge of the galaxy to see what we get, because nobody looks at the galaxy when looking for solar system stuff. If you just plot all the observed fields, the galaxy is a chunk that is completely missing, right? So there's not even, you know, good reference to go to understand what that does, right? So that's it. Hopefully that answers a fraction of your question.
I may be completely off by many orders of magnitude. I have no idea what a 10 solar masses at that kind of distance would do. But haven't there been many spacecrafts that have gone out of the solar system?
Mm-hmm.
And their trajectory must be known quite accurately, right?
Yes, indeed.
Are there discrepancies in their trajectories being perturbed by this?
Yeah, fantastic question. So the latest one is, of course, New Horizons, which went to visit Pluto. Unfortunately, Pluto is exactly the opposite, or so it's going the wrong way. The Voyagers are at 100 astronomical units each. They, I don't know much about the Voyagers because I think that their telemetry is actually not that good, right? They were launched. Yeah, that's right. What the spacecraft with great telemetry is Cassini. And Cassini has been in orbit around Saturn for a decade before we smashed it into Saturn. There was a group in France led by Agnès Fienga and Jacques Lascar who pointed out that if you park Planet 9 at perihelion, where it's clearly not because it would be observable anyway, then Cassini's orbit would be totally messed up. If it's at aphelion, you just don't have any signal. There is, however, a point in the orbit where you park it, which is about halfway to aphelion, where you get the residuals of the Cassini orbit become smaller. In fact, they go away. Right, so there's some residuals in the Cassini telemetry, which can be solved with Planet 9. It's very intriguing, actually, that there's this potential additional
discrepancy.
Yeah, that's right. Discrepancy between what you predict with a JPL, you know, ephemeris model. The problem might lie in the fact that we also don't know the masses of all asteroids. Okay, so what they have, actually, the only constraint they have is the distance between Earth and Cassini itself, the distance between Earth and Saturn. All right, and so because we don't have all the masses of the asteroids down, right, the Earth is a little bit easy to move around. If what would be the ideal experiment is to put an object around Jupiter and an object around Saturn and then just measure the tidal field exerted on the solar system, right? I think that's something that can be done. Okay. So there's some hints of it might be, yeah, of the fact that it might be
worthwhile. Other groups have verified your calculation, I assume?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. And, you know, yeah, everybody that don't find what we find is doing it wrong.
Right, okay. Okay, if there's no other questions, let's thank Constantine.
Thank you.